Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program takes us to Northport and a meeting of the Maine Area Agencies for Aging. The keynote speaker is Ron Pollock, founding executive director of Families USA. He'll discuss the recent healthcare reform and its impact in a talk titled The Next Decade of Healthcare Reform, Impact and Opportunities. This program, along with the rest of the Speaking in Maine series, will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can stream the programs online or download as podcasts, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is John Nail, president of the Maine Association of Area Agencies for Aging.
The Hill, a publication serving Congress, named Mr. Pollock one of the 9 top nonprofit lobbyists. Modern Healthcare named him one of the 100 most powerful people in healthcare. National Journal named him one of the top 25 players in Congress, the administration, and the lobbying community on Medicare. Join us now to welcome and hear Ron Pollock's national perspective on healthcare reform.
This is our recording device right here.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks. Good morning. I haven't been to too many of these conferences, so I was worried about what I should be saying that wouldn't be redundant from things you've heard already. It's actually made me think about something that I experienced a few years ago. I was looking around the room as I am now to see if anyone's paying attention to me, and on that blessed occasion, I wound up being fixated on a woman who was seated in the fourth row. It was a classroom seating arrangement. And she was taking copious notes of everything I was saying. And I felt, this is great. I'm actually reaching somebody. And I could feel the adrenaline coursing through my body. And I thought I actually gave on that occasion a pretty good speech. At the end of the speech, a few people came up, but she was the very first one. And she had this warm, wonderful smile on her face. And she said, Mr. Pollock, I want to thank you. You were absolutely superfluous. So I thanked her. What do you do? But she went on and she said, Mr. Pollock, I want to know, do you intend to do any writing on this subject? So I thought a moment. I think I probably scratched my head. And in the spirit of her previous comment, I said, yes, I intend to do some writing on this subject, and I hope to have it published posthumously. And she looked at me with this warm, wonderful grin, and she said, you know, that's just wonderful, Mr. Pollock, because it just couldn't happen too soon. So I hope I'm not superfluous, and trust me when I say I'm delighted to be here in a guise other than posthumously. I was listening to John's presentation, and I know that Mila Kaufman will be presenting later on. Let me just say, those of us who know the work of various insurance commissioners know that you really have a gem here in Maine with Mila. So I'm thrilled that she's going to be addressing you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the health reform legislation, what it does and what it does not do, and what the challenge is to all of us. Now, as you know, the health reform legislation that passed in March of this year really was the product of work of many decades. Many presidents tried to pass health reform and worked hard at it, but did not succeed. Thankfully, in March of this year, we made a significant step in terms of improving America's healthcare system. Now, I don't want to suggest to you, and I don't think anybody will suggest to you, that the health reform legislation that passed the Congress and that was signed by the President is perfect legislation. It certainly is not. And I think we can all identify some of the things that we wish either were in the bill, that's not, or wish were not in the bill, that is, or would like to see some modifications. But since all of you care deeply about programs that affect senior citizens, I just want to allude to just one historical note. And actually, this came up during the course of the debate. There was a congressman from Arizona who had been very critical of the legislation. And I thought he was making a mistake. And as I was leaving Capitol Hill, we bumped into each other. And I said, Congressman, if I asked you what were, say, the half dozen most significant pieces of domestic legislation that passed our country, could I presume that you would include on that list the Social Security Act of 1935? And he said, of course, that would be right near the top of the list. And I said, well, do you remember the history of the Social Security Act of 1935? He said, no, I don't really. I said, do you know that when the Social Security Act of 1935 was enacted, it did not include agricultural workers, it did not include domestic workers, it did not include teachers. You know, if you aggregate all the people it did not include, it excluded over half the women in the workforce, and it excluded over two-thirds of the people of color in the workforce. And this congressman, who was a Mexican-American, said, I didn't know that. I said, but you still think the Social Security Act of 1935 ranks at the top? And he didn't look like he was as certain as he was before. I said, the reason I think you believe that and should believe that is that it created a foundation. It created a platform. And the various shortcomings of that legislation that resulted in over half the women in the workforce and over two-thirds of the people of color in the workforce being excluded got changed over time. And the health reform legislation, I don't think it has the same deformities, actually, that the Social Security Act had in 1935. I think it's far better than that in terms of what it tries to accomplish. But it is a foundation. It is a platform upon which we are going to build. And if President Obama made one mistake in his rhetoric about the legislation, it was when he spoke before Congress in September, when he described the litany of presidents who fought for health care reform and failed, and he said, I'm going to be the last one, meaning he's going to succeed. And he won't be the last one. He clearly accomplished something that no other president achieved. But we're going to be going back to this legislation over and over again in the years and decades from now to improve that legislation. But it's a huge difference between where we would be today if that legislation didn't pass, as opposed to now this important foundation that has been laid. Now, I want to do a few things in this presentation with you. First, I want to talk for a moment, I'm going to take this out of order from my usual talks, about what the challenges are in front of us today. And then I'm going to talk about some of the key provisions in the legislation and what gets implemented this year. Let me start, though, because everyone has got to figure out after you leave here, after this conference, what is it that lies ahead of us? And I would say that there are three enormous challenges that lie ahead of all of us in terms of what we do as a result of the legislation. In no particular order, they include the following. Number one, one thing you have to keep in mind throughout the months ahead is that there are going to be significant efforts to repeal this legislation or to eviscerate it. You see this in a variety of different ways that have already reared their heads. There is litigation pending in about 24 states to try to repeal significant parts of the legislation. There are referenda that are pending in several states to repeal certain parts of the legislation. A number of members of Congress, a number of those running for office in Congress are saying if they can't repeal it, they're going to, in quote, starve the beast, meaning they're not going to provide funding to the agencies that are supposed to implement this legislation. And, you know, when you look at 2,700 pages of legislation and the many different programs and provisions that require significant change, it is going to require significant, thoughtful staff people to work at the federal level and at the state level to implement this legislation. We have got to be mindful of what's in this legislation. The most important thing that we can do is to try to undertake public education about what's in this legislation so we can sort out fact from fiction. I'm going to try and do a little of that here in my talk this morning. But part of the mixed public reception to health reform is that a lot of the myths about the health reform legislation are still being purveyed and are still being felt. I was surprised that John didn't introduce me as having recently gotten an appointment to a death panel. Some of you may have heard that some of the opponents of health reform were saying that there were death panels, and of course that's not true. So one of the key things we all have to do is we have to try to help people in our communities understand what is in this legislation and what is not in the legislation. The second thing that we have to do is we got to get the implementation right. We got to get the implementation done right at the federal level and at the state level. And most of the action is going to be at the state level. As I'm going to describe in a few moments, there are some major changes that are going to occur with respect to the Medicaid program, with the Medicare program, and there's going to be this new animal that does not exist in almost any state across the country, and that is there's going to be a new marketplace created, and they'll have the term exchange, where people will be able to select from a variety of different plans, and those people with incomes below 400% of the federal poverty level. What am I talking about? 400% of the federal poverty level for a family of four is $88,200 in income. This reaches deeply into the middle class. Will be receiving tax credit subsidies to help them afford premiums. These systems have got to be created. And they've got to be created in a way that harmonize systems like Medicaid and the plans in the exchange. And this is a Herculean effort. And much of that effort is going to occur at the state level. And the third challenge is that, as you know, there are huge numbers of people who don't have health insurance coverage today. The Census Bureau told us just about a month ago that in 2009, the number of people without health insurance coverage was 50.7 million people. Now, that's a huge number. Nobody can sort of put their arms around that number and figure out really what that means. But let me give you one way of thinking about it. 50.7 million is a number that's larger than the combined, and I underscore the word combined, population of 25 states plus the District of Columbia. Now, obviously, I'm talking about the least populous states, of which Maine is one of them. But can you imagine? There are more people uninsured in our nation last year than the population of half the states in our country. So one of the big challenges that all of us have is to make sure that the new opportunities to get people covered actually work. And one of the things I'm really happy to say is, despite all the contentiousness about the health reform legislation, and the contentiousness was enormous, every one of the stakeholder organizations in America's healthcare system are joining together on one key effort, whether it's the insurance companies, the hospitals, the pharmaceutical companies, the medical device groups, the physician groups, the consumer organizations. We are joining together to get everybody enrolled who's newly eligible for coverage, either through Medicaid or these new exchanges. And there's a new organization that has just been chartered to try and undertake this work called Enroll America. And we are going to try to create collaboratives in every one of the 50 states to try to make sure that systems are put in place so that we make sure everybody truly gets enrolled. When I say systems, I mean things like people shouldn't have to take a day off from work in order to get enrolled. The application form should be simple. They should be in multiple languages for those people whose primary language is not English. We should have online systems so that people can get enrolled at hospitals, at pharmacies, at physician offices, in places like Walmart's. So an effort is going to be made to try to make sure we truly reach everybody. And the reason that's so important is that the Congressional Budget Office, which is the official scorekeeper in Washington, the Congressional Budget Office tells us that they project that this new legislation will expand health care coverage for 32 million people. Now, the Congressional Budget Office has a very good group of analysts. And because they are good analysts, they understand that in the past, programs that were tried to provide coverage for people or other means-tested programs missed a lot of people who were eligible. A lot of people eligible for those programs never signed up. And so our belief is that if we do this work well, we're going to get enrolled well over 40 million people who don't have health coverage today. And by the way, this is of significance to everyone in this room who has health care coverage. And the reason it has significance, and I'm not just talking about in a spiritual or altruistic manner, for all of us who have health insurance coverage, we pay higher amounts in premiums the larger the number of uninsured people are in this country, for obvious reasons. When somebody's uninsured and they have an accident or they have a major illness and they go to the hospital and they get treated at the hospital and they can't pay for the services, who pays for that? Those who have insurance when they get services. And what does that mean with respect to our premiums? It means that the premiums go up. And on average, premiums for family coverage 2 years ago had an add-on that you didn't see listed in your premiums of over $1,000 a year to pay for the uncompensated health care costs of the uninsured. So when we expand coverage to those who don't have it today, it means that hidden surcharge will keep on getting lower and lower and hopefully ultimately eliminated. So what does this legislation do? Well, first, since I was just talking about coverage, there are two key ways that coverage are expanded in this legislation. The first is by expanding the safety net program, Medicaid. And the way that's going to be expanded is that eligibility for everyone, irrespective of family status, will go to at least 133% of the federal poverty level. 133% of the federal poverty level for a family of four is approximately $29,300 in annual income. Now, this is not a huge change in Maine. It is a change, but it is not as big a change in Maine as it is in other states across the country, because in most states across the country, there are huge disparities between three different low-income groups: children, the parents of children, and other adults who are singles and are in childless couples. Around the country, the eligibility standard for children as a result of the confluence of Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, in virtually every state, it's at least 200% of the federal poverty level. In some states, it's quite a bit higher than that. New Jersey goes to 350% of poverty. New York goes to 400% of poverty. But in virtually every state, the eligibility for children's coverage in the safety net programs is at least 200% of poverty. Not so for parents. For parents, the median income eligibility standard among the 50 states is not 200% of poverty, it's not 100% of poverty, it's 67% of poverty. And states, particularly in the Southeast, have eligibility standards at about 25% of poverty. And so people under any reasonable standard are poor, are ineligible for the safety net if they're parents. And it means the kids may be eligible for safety net coverage, but their parents are not. And by the way, that has a deleterious effect on kids, because kids are more likely to get enrolled in these programs if they can do so with their family. But if you think it's bad with respect to parents, it's far worse for adults who are not parents, who do not have dependent children. In 44 states, you literally can be penniless and you're ineligible for Medicaid if you don't have any dependent children. Now, Maine is different in this respect. You have eligibility standard, if I remember correctly, at about 100% of poverty for non-parental adults. Shake your head if I've got that incorrect. But I believe Maine is one of those exceptional states that actually does something for non-parental adults. Now it's going to mean everybody will be eligible based on need and income as opposed to family status. That's a big deal. Now, above that, I saw a lot of hands when John asked about the baby boomers who are not yet 65, not yet eligible for Medicare. But there's relief for people under 65 years of age as well. I will talk about how relief is going to be provided for people 65 and older in a moment. But if you have income above 133% of poverty and you don't have coverage, or you have coverage that is far too expensive through your employer, you will now be able to go into this new marketplace called an exchange, and the exchange will array a wide variety of plans, presumably, just like members of Congress have, and you can select the plan that you want. However, if you have income, family income, below 400% of poverty, you will get an advanceable, refundable, sliding scale tax credit. Now, what do I mean by those words? By advanceable, I mean you will get the benefit of the tax credit when you pay your premiums, not April 15th of the following year. You will actually get that contemporaneously with the time that you need to pay your premiums. By refundable, I mean there are those people or families that have a limited tax liability, and the tax credit is larger than their tax liability. They will get a refund. And by sliding scale, I mean that for those people eligible for the tax credit, the greater the need, the greater the tax credit. And so this is going to provide help to a rather significant number of people. We looked at the Maine numbers, and by our estimate, there are a little over 125,000 people in the state of Maine who will be eligible for the tax credit, of which most of them actually have health insurance today. About 53,000 are uninsured, over 72,000 are insured. And so it not only will help people who don't have insurance gain coverage, but for those who do have coverage but are having difficulty paying for it, they are going to receive rather significant relief. Now, by the way, with respect to this Medicaid improvement, the federal government is going to pick up 100% of the costs of that improvement in the period 2014 to 2016. Then over time, the federal government's share diminishes, but it never goes below 90%. And so the lion's share is going to be paid by the federal government. Now, what are the other key provisions that are in this legislation? There are very significant health insurance reforms that are very important for baby boomers because they're more likely to have a health condition than young adults. So what's in the legislation? The legislation prohibits an insurance company from denying coverage due to a pre-existing health condition. It prohibits insurance companies from charging a discriminatory and higher premium based on health status. It prohibits insurance companies from charging a higher premium based on gender. Women generally are required to pay a higher premium than men, and some of my friends in the women's community say that they did not think that being a woman was a pre-existing condition. This legislation hopes to engraft that. There are other key provisions. Many people who have insurance when they have a major illness, like cancer, wind up running right through a cap in how much the insurance company is going to pay, either a lifetime cap or an annual cap. Lifetime cap ends right now. By 2014, an annual cap will be ended as well. So it means that people who have insurance are not going to go bankrupt, despite the fact that they have coverage, just because they contract a major illness. There will not be rescissions in coverage. What I mean by rescissions, you often hear insurance companies that collect premiums every month, every year, and then all of a sudden somebody gets sick and they drop you from your insurance policy, saying you should have disclosed to us that you had this problem or that problem and you didn't do it, so we're dropping you from insurance. And often it's for specious reasons. That no longer is allowed. There's a requirement that your premium dollar be used in a whole lot more efficient manner than in the past. And there's this term, I don't know whether you've heard the term before, but there's this raging debate in Washington among policy mavens called medical loss ratios. What does medical loss ratios mean? The term medical loss ratios means what portion of your premium dollar actually gets spent on health care or quality improvements, as opposed to such things as CEO compensation, advertising and other kinds of marketing, agents' fees, other administrative costs, and profits. Under the legislation, in the small business market and in the individual market, at least 80 cents of the dollar needs to be spent on the provision of healthcare services and on qualitative improvements. In the large business market, 85 cents of the dollar. And yesterday in Florida, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and I'm sure Mila is a part of that because it includes all the insurance commissioners, issued their proposed regulations about how you interpret these medical loss ratios. And Secretary Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, will now review them. But the key point to be made out of all this is that there will be greater efficiency of the use of your premium dollars than ever before. So now let me turn to seniors, because I know that's of deepest interest to all of you. And first, let me talk about what's not in this legislation, because there's been so much scare stuff targeted at seniors that we really have to clear the air about this. Obviously, the one that got so much attention in the media were these death panels. You know where this debate arose is that there was money originally in the legislation that would enable seniors to consult with their physicians about the best course of treatment given any illness they may have, so they can make wise decisions. And it was not an effort to have anybody, government or elsewhere, make decisions for seniors. Rather, it was designed to provide some resources so that when seniors are confused or concerned about the course of treatment, particularly if they have a major illness, they can actually get consultation with a physician and they won't have to pay out of pocket for that consultation. That's what that provision was all about. And the opponents of health care reform said those are death panels, that this is a way of trying to accelerate decisions that somebody else is going to make other than a physician or the senior, him or herself, in terms of their treatment of care. And nothing could be further from the truth. Unfortunately, this scare tactic then resulted in our losing that piece in the legislation that enables seniors to consult with their physicians and have that paid for. Because the proponents of health care reform wanted to get rid of this absurd claim, and it came from that provision. So that provision, which would have been helpful to all of us, was dropped from the legislation. Death panels, no. Now, the other thing that seniors were told throughout the debate is Medicare is going to really be cut in a big way. And the figure you kept on hearing throughout the debate was that there was going to be $500 billion in cuts in the Medicare program over the next 10 years. Well, like many things, there's a figment of truth, but the bigger picture is it's totally untrue. There are going to be greater efficiencies in the Medicare program, and I'm going to describe some of them for you, and that's how you get to the $500 billion figure that was cited. But there will not be a cut in benefits for America's seniors. There are going to be greater efficiencies in the Medicare program to try to eliminate some of the waste in that program, and I think we should all herald that. And by the way, when Congress achieved that, one of the things that resulted from that is that the life of the Medicare Part A trust fund, the inpatient trust fund, which was supposed to go belly up before the legislation, the health reform legislation passed in 2017, the life of the trust fund has been extended 12 years to 2029. Not perfect. You know, we want it extended forever. But this is now actually going to significantly improve the fiscal condition of the Medicare trust fund. So where did this claim about the $500 billion come up? Well, there are some changes in the legislation, and I happen to think they're very good ones, and I presume when you look further into it, so will you. Perhaps the most prominent one related to how we pay private insurance companies in the so-called Medicare Advantage program. Now, the Medicare Advantage program has its roots in a program that has had different names at different times over years. And the notion that when the initial forms of Medicare Advantage were implemented was that Medicare Advantage would achieve two things. Number one, it would achieve better coordinated care. And secondly, it would save money. That was the presumption. And when the Medicare Advantage program started, actually, for each person in a Medicare Advantage plan, the Medicare program provided 95% of the average payment to a Medicare Advantage plan that was provided to the fee-for-service system. And what was interesting is a lot of agencies that nonpartisan agencies that studied it said that when these Medicare Advantage plans received 95%, in other words, 5% less than was provided on average for the fee-for-service system, that the Medicare Advantage plans were paid too much. Now, why? That doesn't sound logical, does it? Well, the reason for that conclusion was that the private plans cherry-picked. They tried to enroll the youngest and healthiest seniors. And when you do that, your real costs are a whole lot less than 5% from the average cost of seniors. And so there was a lot of push to reduce below 95% the per capita payments. Fast forward to where we are today. Today, Medicare Advantage plans get 114% of what is provided in the fee-for-service system. And this is purely a windfall for insurance companies that are offering Medicare Advantage plans. Yes, Medicare Advantage plans do provide some additional benefits. There's no question that's true. But a significant part of that, and you can see it from the SEC statements filed by the various insurance companies, this was a major profit center for the insurance companies. And so one of the things that Congress did, when I said they tried to create efficiencies in the Medicare program, was they said, let's stop these windfall payments to the private plans. And that is precisely what was included in the legislation. That alone saves the Medicare program $145 billion. Now, mind you, because of the overpayments, because of the way the Medicare law operates, those overpayments actually cost those people in the fee-for-service system additional premiums as well. And so that is going to help get premiums slightly lower than they are today. So that's one of the key savings when you hear about the $500 billion. Another key saving was that the Obama administration and the leaders in Congress went to other parts of the healthcare industry to try to achieve savings. And one area where they achieved significant savings was with respect to prescription drugs. And they went to pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association, and the companies that sell prescription drugs. And they got rebates from the pharmaceutical companies in order to reduce some of the costs in the Medicare program. And that saved a very substantial amount of money. There were additional savings. The hospital industry was asked to create some greater efficiencies. Right now, the way we pay hospitals for each service that is provided. Another way of saying that is we pay for quantity of services rather than quality of services. That is going to change over time. And as that happens, there are going to be significant savings. There are a lot of people who are admitted to a hospital, then are discharged, and wind up being readmitted a week or 2 weeks later. Now there are going to be lesser payments to hospitals who don't provide appropriate care and that result in readmissions that could have been avoided had care been provided appropriately in the first place. Those are the kinds of savings that constitute the approximate $500 billion. And I suggest to you they make a lot of sense. They create efficiencies in the system. You know, when people say let's get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse, that's an easy throwaway line. But there actually is waste in the system. And what I've just described are some of the ways that this legislation is designed to change that waste. So I wanted to describe that to you because the opponents of health reform have been trying to scare senior citizens by saying $500 billion is going to be cut. And so you're wondering, you know, what's going to be cut from my prescription drug services? What's going to be cut when I go to physician? There are not cuts that affect benefits in the program. Now, there are some real benefits, however, for seniors in this legislation. And I'll cite a few of them for you. First, all of you know about this huge gap in coverage that people experience with respect to prescription drugs under Part D of Medicare. The euphemistically called donut hole. Now, what is that donut hole for those of you who are not familiar with it? The way it works today is people get help for the first $2,830 in prescription drug costs, and they make a 25% copayment after a deductible, and the first $2,830 in prescription drug benefits is largely paid through Part D. 75% is paid through Part D. After you've reached $2,830, then there is this big gap in coverage. And that gap extends for the next $3,610 in prescription drug costs that people have. So that for that next $3,610, you're on your own. You pay 100% of those costs. And if you can't afford it, if you're somebody who unfortunately has to take multiple medicines because you've got multiple chronic conditions, now you're really in real deep trouble because you may not be able to afford the drugs that you need. But it's only after you've paid that additional $3,610 does coverage start again. That's what's meant by that gap in coverage, euphemistically called the donut hole. And as I just said, in this year, the gap is $3,610. The Congressional Budget Office estimate that by 2018, if the legislation did not pass, that gap would grow from $3,610 to $6,000 in 2018. So this is huge. And the legislation is designed to fix that. Now, it doesn't do it overnight. It takes incremental steps, but it does ultimately fix it. So this year, people who fall into the donut hole are getting a $250 payment. And checks have been going out to people as they fall into the donut hole. Starting January 1, the people who fall into the donut hole will get a 50% discount on all brand name drugs so that they'll only have to bear half of those costs. And this help will increase with each passing year, and by 2020, there will be no donut hole whatsoever, zero donut hole. And so it's going to provide significant new helpful relief to seniors who have multiple health care conditions. So that's number one. Number two, this legislation provides significant relief to seniors in terms of making preventive care available to them. Under this legislation, preventive care services, including an annual physical exam, are now free. There are no co-payments, there are no deductibles, and the purpose of this is to try to make sure that seniors get health care, not just sick care, so that people can understand, can get a diagnosis, they can get various tests, whether they're screenings for cancer or other kinds of illnesses that people are afraid of, and they can get this done on an early basis. So now these services are going to be provided for free. The third area that I think is very significant, and as John was talking about earlier when he was talking about people with chronic health conditions who need help, all of our policy is leaning towards institutionalization rather than home and community-based care. And most people, when they've got a condition that causes some restrictions in their activities of daily living, they still want to live independently as best as possible. They want to live in their home if they can. They want to live in their community if they can. But policies so far in the area of long-term care have really pushed people more towards institutionalization, because the biggest source of funding for long-term care has been the Medicaid program. And the Medicaid program has provided far greater benefits in terms of those people who wind up in an institution. And for those people who want care in the home community, have to get waivers, and there are all sorts of rigmarole that has made it difficult for people to get the help they need in the place they most want it. The legislation takes incremental steps in the direction to correct this bias towards institutionalization. It does so with a new program called the CLASS Act that you'll hear more about, and it does so by changing the way Medicaid functions so that states are going to be given greater payments with respect to those that correct this imbalance between institutional care and home and community-based services. I think this is something that's welcome, and it's something that hopefully we can build on in the future so that we can provide a real service system and in the process create a workforce for people who can serve folks. We don't have an adequate workforce. And that is something the legislation also takes some initial steps towards improving. So let me conclude by talking about some of the things that go into effect right now or that are in effect right now. This part really applies to people irrespective of age. First, the rules that I described that prevent insurance companies from discriminating against health status, most of those rules go into effect in 2014. In the interim, money has been provided to states so that they can create high-risk pools or expand their high-risk pools so that people who have chronic conditions who can't find an insurance company that's willing to sell coverage to them can get into a high-risk pool. Secondly, the states have been given money so that they can beef up their staff to review insurance premium increase requests. You know, there have been a lot of requests for insurance premium hikes that I think under any reasonable standard have been far too high, way in excess of general cost of health care. Now insurance commissions, like the one here in Maine with such an excellent leader in that agency, Mila Kaufman, will now get some financial help so that they can beef up their staffs to review requests for increases in premiums. And the federal government will be reviewing these premium increases as well. The medical loss ratios that I described, they are going to go into effect in the next few months. New health insurance policies, not just in Medicare, will also provide preventive care services, even for younger populations, for free without deductibles and co-payments. We've already ended lifetime caps in coverage. By 2014, we'll have ended annual caps in how much coverage. Tax credits are already provided to small businesses, so that small businesses which are struggling to afford coverage for their workers and have increasingly found that coverage unaffordable are going to be getting help. We've ended rescissions so that these inappropriate terminations of insurance coverage by insurance companies when somebody gets sick are a thing of the past. There's been increased funds to community health centers so that people who need care can go to community health centers and have a greater likelihood of getting service. And for young adults, they can now retain coverage through their parents' policy up to the age of 26. The lesson, of course, to young adults is be good to your parents so they continue to provide coverage to you. So the bottom line is, this legislation provides significant help for many different people of different ages, not least of which America's seniors. And it's not perfect, and we're going to have to improve it, but it is an enormous step forward. And now it's up to all of us to make sure it gets implemented effectively, that we tell our neighbors and our friends and family members what's in this legislation so they can figure out how to use this system most effectively, and so that we're not prey to mythology. And we need to make sure that everybody who is eligible for certain benefits gets enrolled. And I look forward to working with all of you on these endeavors. I'll end with a story. How many of you remember the name Claude Pepper? Good. Claude Pepper was not simply a leader and champion for senior citizens. He was also a champion to change America's healthcare system. And he very much wanted to make sure that everybody had health care coverage. And the story goes, when Claude Pepper passed away, he ascended the pearly gates to heaven, and he was met by St. Peter. And St. Peter said, "Senator, we want to welcome you here to heaven. You've lived an exemplary life. How can we make your life here in heaven a good one?" And Pepper was normally a pretty brusque, always right to the point, said, "I want to talk to the Lord. I want to find out, are we going to get universal health coverage in the United States?" And St. Peter said, "You know, we've never gotten a request like that before. But I'll tell you, you've lived such a wonderful life. I'll talk to the Lord and see whether she's willing to entertain your request. So you come by here tomorrow, and we'll see whether the Lord will be willing to answer your question." So the next day, Pepper came back, and St. Peter came back, and St. Peter said, "Senator, I've spoken to the Lord, and in light of the wonderful life you've led, she's willing to entertain your request. You wait here. The Lord will be by here momentarily." And the Lord came and said, "Senator, I heard from St. Peter you've got this very unusual request of me." Pepper didn't even go into the niceties and said, "Yes, Lord, I want to find out, are we going to get universal health coverage in the United States?" And the Lord looked at Pepper and said, "Well, Senator, I've got some good news for you and some bad news for you. The good news is we will get universal health coverage in the United States. The bad news is it won't happen in my lifetime." "Well, we can actually do something about this and achieve it, not just in our lifetime, in the next few years. And I look forward to working with all of you as we try to make sure that young and old, rich and poor, have the health system that we all deserve. So thank you so much for inviting me."
You've been listening to Ron Pollack speaking before a meeting of the Maine Area Agencies for Aging. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can access it online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.